Tony Hernandez Pumarejo, writer and author, professional and motivational speaker, TV presenter, life coach, and international ambassador for autism and mental health. He is proud to invite you to his podcast, My Time, with Tony Hernandez Pumarejo.
Hi, and welcome to this new episode of My Time with Tony Hernandez Pumarejo. And this is your host, Tony Hernandez Pumarejo. And this is a podcast in which we bring inspirational and unique stories, from different individuals around the world, you know, autism, mental health, and many other causes in our community. If you haven't done so yet, please subscribe to my podcast, My Time, on all the platforms, Spotify, YouTube, iHeartRadio, Apple, Google. There's so many of them that I don't know all the platforms, but please follow my channels under Tony Hernandez Pumarejo. Subscribe to the podcast. Your support is crucial. So today I had the honor and the privilege to be interviewing a person who I had the most respect for, especially in our autism community. His name is Mr. James Williams, born and raised, living in Northbrook, Illinois. James Williams is an advocate for autism, being diagnosed with autism. And he has done a lot of work for our community. And we're going to be learning about his story. And not only as part of learning about his story from James, he brought a very special guest. His name is Mr. Will Rogers. That's which nice. Mr. Rogers is a crucial part of James Williams' life. So that's the reason why he's here. So this is a very special, unique interview. So James, it is my honor and privilege to have you here in my podcast, My Time with Tony Hernandez Pumarejo. Thank you so much for coming in.
You're very welcome, Tony.
Perfect. Well, James, I always start with this question. I mean, I learned about your story, your work, and definitely your work for the art community speaks for itself. I always start with this very simple question. Everything that you live in your life as an advocate and your life story, I forgot to mention in my introduction that you're also you play an instrument, right? What was the instrument that you play?
The recorder.
That's right, that you're a professional. James is also a professional recorder player. He performs at different events, and also written books and CDs as well, which we're going to talk about that, in our interview today. But James, I'm going to start with this very important question. How do you define the life of James Williams in just a few words?
Well, the way I define it is I am someone who lives with a lot of struggles and difficulties related to my autism, but I'm also someone who has had a very unique and enjoyable life because of my autism as well. One of the things that I tell people is that autism awareness does not have to equate autism denial. I am proud of being autistic, but that doesn't mean that I'm not unaware of all the challenges and struggles that I deal with on a daily basis because of my autism.
That's amazing to hear. And how did this story start, James? If we can go from the beginning, starting with your diagnosis.
So this story began, I was diagnosed with autism at the age of 3 for the first time. Now, I didn't know that I had autism back then, but I remember from as early as I can, knowing that I was different from other people. And what eventually happened was that as I grew older, I could see the differences. I could see, I'm upset and things are causing me pain, but they're not causing other people pain. And people are understanding things when I'm not understanding. People are feeling things differently. And Why is it that adults are expecting me to know things that I don't? And so I went through a phase of just, you know, thinking, there's got to be something different about me. And I created this little mythology in my head. You know, maybe just, you know, people are just cruel and that's just the way people are. But then when I was 8 years old, my mother finally sat me down and said, you know what? James, I want to tell you the truth. You have autism. And that was very powerful because suddenly I had an answer as to what was going on, why I was so different than other people. And the moment I learned I had autism, from that very moment, I wanted to help other people going through what I was going through. I also always had a dream of writing books. And it was actually around that time that I was having a lot of issues in school. And my mom pulled me out of school. It was the second grade, and she homeschooled me. And during that time of home education, it was a whole journey of self-discovery and exploration. Now I know what's going on. Now I know what I'm going through and how to deal with it. And my dad, he was very tech savvy, loved computers and technology. And he just, when the internet came out, he was like, I want to learn about the internet. And he built this website for our family. And then my mom and I started writing a book together when I was a kid. And through whatever, we also got involved with various autism organizations. And through that grapevine, I ended up meeting this person sitting next to me, Mr. William Rogers. He emailed me when I was a kid and introduced himself. And at that time, he was a young adult and I was a young child, but he emailed me. We had a nice correspondence for quite some time. And then he really helped inspire me to become an autism advocate. And then we saw each other at a few conferences back in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Back then there was a conference that existed called MAP. And MAP was an organization that stood for, it might seem offensive now, but at the time it was not seen as such. It stood for more advanced autistic people. And while that might seem offensive now, back at the time that organization was created, you had a very distinct issue in the self-advocacy community where most organizations were focusing on severe autistic individuals, those who couldn't talk, those who could not talk, couldn't get dressed, really couldn't take care of themselves. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of support for the higher functioning individuals. People like myself were articulate. We still have social issues, we're articulate, we can, you know, get dressed and do a lot of basic things other autistic people can't. So MAP was created to try to fill that gap. Let's have an organization for those that are a little more higher functioning. And they created a conference for that group. And after Will and I corresponded, we met for the first time in person at that conference. Sadly, that organization went under and those conferences are no more, but at the time, that organization helps so many people with autism who were higher functioning and had skills other autistic people didn't, and gave them a place that they so desperately needed back then.
That's amazing what you're sharing, James. You know, not only, you know, what caught my attention was that at age 8, you became aware about autism. This is what I have. And that began your true journey. Similar to my story, it took a couple years later. I found out I was diagnosed at age 3, right? But it wasn't until age 14 that I learned about autism for the first time. And it's interesting and it's valuable what you're sharing in terms of what was the advocacy, let's put it this way, the environment in regards to autism advocacy in the late 90s compared to what it is now. Do you think that right now, compared to when you started, because you started, when do you became a be start you started advocacy very young, right?
Yes, no. My mom and I started writing my first book right after I found out I was autistic. And then I gave my first presentation when I was 11 in Wisconsin, answering questions after another presenter. And then I gave some of my first presentations at the MAP conferences that Will Rogers here got to see. And Will, who is currently now in middle adulthood, he's seen a lot of changes too in how advocacy has changed. And one of the things I want to remind people is that it's very easy to look back at something and think, oh my gosh, how could these people be so offensive? How could these people say certain words and certain things? But what you have to realize is that what ultimately matters is not necessarily what words are used, but how did the people who were being spoken up for, how did the marginalized people back then feel about those words? I mean, truth be told, history shows this. Even among, civil rights speeches back in the 1960s, civil rights activists who were fighting for minorities were using words that we would not use today. But clearly, these people were not using those words to offend anybody. They were actually using them to fight for people. And so I tell people, when you hear about terminology in a historical era, the question is, was that terminology being used to put people down? Or was that how people spoke up for one another?
That's the reason why I say, hey, I'm okay. I call myself advocate, right? But for me, I'm just like a student today, learning from both of you. And I know James for several years now. I always say that James, in terms of autism, a lot of times I refer to James because he's been in this, for the longest, and not only the time, but also the experiences that he's. The evolution that, James, that you have seen from the late 90s, right? The 90s until now, in terms of how it's evolved with the languages, the way we see autism, not only autism, but disability as well, because we have to take into the account with the emergence of neurodiversity, which right in the 90s wasn't, I don't know if the word neurodiversity, right, existed at that time or it
Yeah,
wasn't.
no, it didn't. And one of the things that like I said, I'm not trying to repeat myself, but I think
It's
we
okay.
really have to remind ourselves that while it's definitely true that, people did use a lot of offensive language historically, and many people still do, just because people have used words that offend people with autism or other disabilities, and just because something is offensive now doesn't necessarily mean that everything people said at one time was offensive. I mean, we really have to look into the context of, okay, how did the people with disabilities feel? And also, what are the people using that language for? Because many times, you can tell a story about bullies and intolerant people, and you can quote some offensive things they said, but that doesn't mean you support that language. It means, you know what? You're just trying to tell the truth about what bullies do. And there have been many misunderstood, books and movies about bullies and bad people. And one thing I tell people is, a movie about bad people saying bad words doesn't necessarily mean the filmmakers support what the bad people are doing. I mean, it's not like, we lock up filmmakers who make murder mysteries. Just because if someone writes a murder mystery doesn't mean that they think people should be murdering people. And so I think that's the lens we need to look at with advocacy. What are the words being used for? Are they really trying to put people down? Or A, is that just how people help people back then? Because, yes, people said a lot of offensive things historically, but they also said things differently to help people.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to look at it from the context and also what was happening in the world. With the changes in society, the events that were happening, the world, it's not the same as it was 20 years ago, 25 years ago. A lot, the world has evolved and that has had an impact, right?
And plus, too, the term neurodivergence, it wasn't widely known because that was really a term that was created as a response to new research. I mean, I think of the fact that since the 1990s, we now have all this research showing just not only are there so many different types of autism, but there's a large population of people who have some symptoms of autism but aren't necessarily fully autistic. There's also a lot of people who have autism but aren't able to be diagnosed because of various obstacles and prejudice. And so that term really, in my opinion, was, yeah, now that we know that there's a whole population of people that probably do have some form of autism, but they're not getting diagnosed, neurodivergence is a way of acknowledging their story.
Okay. No, and that's important to know. And I want to ask you, James, and also Will as well. Do you think that right now we're more to get, right now there's also different opinions about as well, as you were talking about, not only with the language in terms of how to see it. Oh, it's not a disability, it's a condition, it's identity. A lot of times that can create confusion, to be honest, again. And do you think that we have really I'm gonna ask a very serious question. Do you guys, both of you, think and believe that we have to, are we truly involving in making sure that we're helping more people that are with autism or any other condition? Or what do you think? I don't know if I made the question clear. Do you want me to repeat it?
Sure.
Okay, what I'm trying to say is, there has been an evolution. Things have evolved in regards to autism, disability rights, the emergence of neurodiversity, neurodivergent terms due to the
Yeah.
research, also of the impacts in our society, the changes in our society, being more open to talk about this maybe than years past. People that didn't have the tools back then, let's say not only 90s, but also 80s, 60s, 70s. There are adults today and they're realizing that hey, I didn't got the support that I needed. But at the same time, we have, and I had to, you guys both know about this. We have more debates about the different things in the community. But do you guys, both of you, think there are we are truly involving towards helping more people with autism and the families? Or do you think that we still have a long ways to go, even though, there has to build
Yeah,
this.
people definitely still have a long way to go.
Because, for example, with the debates, right? Whether it's the use of the language, criticism of different debates. I had to say ABA therapy, for example. The debates about the parents being right, being wrong. You listen to autistic voices, right? For example, my autism is, I'm autistic, you're not. I mean, so many, it's not a disability, it's an identity. Those debates, those, and you guys both know about this. Probably you guys more about this than me because you are live in this community. I've been part of this advocacy, since almost, only t right now, this year, it's gonna be 10 years, even though I was diagnosed with a condition at three, right? But you guys have been doing, you've been the advocacy front in for decades. So based on what you have seen and how we are going so far as a community, are we truly evolving towards fulfilling that mission of a quality of life for everybody on the autism spectrum and their families?
Maybe, but I think people still have a long way to go.
What do you think, James?
I do think that we have absolutely. And although I do think, yes, like Will, we still have a long way to go, the reality is that we know scientifically a lot more about autism than we did when I was a kid 20 years ago. We are now also realizing just how much autistic people have different experiences based on culture. We understand that autistic voices are valid and need to be listened to. But at the same time, I do think that we are making a mistake by trying to argue that the validity of autistic voices necessitates invalidating the voices of family members and others. The reality is, as the old saying goes, two wrongs don't make a right. Silencing anyone who has something worth saying is wrong. Doesn't matter who the person is. And one thing that does frustrate me is when you have people on the autism spectrum who complain about being silenced, so then turn around and make that same mistake and try to silence those who are not autistic. My belief is, I don't care if you have autism or not. If you're doing something to help the autism community, then your voice is valid too. If you're a parent who cares about your autistic child, who loves your autistic child, and yeah, you struggled so much raising your child, I will defend your right to speak as well.
Exactly, because this is a community. I mean, I mean, again, the way I see it, as well, is that autism, also the families live autism. That's the reality.
Yeah.
The parents, the moms, go ahead, sorry.
And we also have to be more aware of how autism is differently works, how autism impacts people differently among cultures. I mean, I know you well enough, Tony, that you are very active in the Spanish-speaking community, and you probably see many differences between how autistic people experience autism in a Spanish-speaking community versus more mainstream English American speaking community. You see that. And I also have to admire the fact that neurotypical professionals who for a long time created, social skills curriculums and all these, unspoken rule curriculums solely based on, white English American communities and are realizing, yeah, we have to realize that unspoken rules aren't the same in every culture, and even when you have an autistic person that doesn't understand the unspoken rules in their culture, those rules are not going to be the same in a Spanish-speaking community, in a French-speaking community, in an American English-speaking community, in whatever community that person grows up in. And I have hope in seeing that more people are realizing those things. But the truth is, we're never going to run out of new information with autism. It is such a complex disorder. But ultimately, silencing anyone who has a valuable viewpoint and something to say isn't going to help anybody.
Exactly. What do you think, Will, about?
Well, I certainly do agree that parents and family members of people with autism should speak too, but I feel the same way about specialists who've never lived with autism giving presentations about autism that Native Americans feel about white people giving presentations about their culture.
No, definitely. And going along those lines, I mean, the professionals that work with the population, as well. I think that in this world, I call it the world because there's different groups and the parents, professional, autistic human beings. And we need to get the resources and the tools to achieve. All of us, we want the same thing. If you guys, again, if we look at it, okay. A quality of better quality of life, right? It's how to get there. I think that we can work without the with different with our differences, not mean that all of us are going to agree on the same thing. And we're not saying that, but in an environment of respect and understanding and listening, I think we can make great strides. Again, a lot has been a progress has been made, but so much still needs to be done. And you're saying it right, James, for example. Each of us has a different an experience, different, common and different experiences. back our background, cultural backgrounds, where we come from, where we grew up, right? And that takes into consideration. I mean, there's so much talking about from my aunt. Don't want to talk about too much about myself. This is you guys' interview. The Hispanic community has its own challenges. The autism Hispanic community has their own challenges. One thing that also needs to be talked about more, the immigrants. And I work with immigrant families and how and the difficulty that they're having to access the supports that needs to be talked about more. I mean, the cultural backgrounds, not only not only the US, but other parts of the world. How are other countries are doing with services and supports with autism, or how they view autism still in other countries? It's very interesting. I mean, a lot of things that still need to be worked on. But I think that having that environment with respect and understanding is crucial. So that way we can truly move ahead. So I know this is something that we cannot talk about in an hour interview. There's
No.
and I and I'm if you guys are more than welcome to come back later on. And to discuss several of these topics, that would be fantastic. Because again, this is a diff this is something that had to be taken care of different conversations. So, and I appreciate both of you sharing your experiences. And now, go ahead, start, James.
What I tell people is I actually don't really disagree with Will's statement about specialists who do not understand autism. But I really think the dividing line is, I ask not when I see someone talk about autism, are you autistic? But what is your experience with autism? And there's a difference between a specialist speaking about autism who's never come across an autistic person in their lives, than someone who does have experience working with autistic people, or a parent who is raising autistic children.
Exactly. There's a difference. There's a big difference between those two. Definitely. And going along these lines, now, James, learning about more about your story. So tell us about what you do. We learned a little bit about your story growing up. So tell us about what you do as an adult with autism, about the work that you do. Can you tell us a little bit?
So I wear several hats throughout my life. I give presentations throughout most of the United States about autism and related subjects, but I don't just go to autism and disability events. I go to a wide variety of events to share my story. I have gone to hobo conventions, anime conventions, gaming conventions. I've also gone to Native American events with full support from Native American leaders running those events to tell my story as well. And what I tell people is, since autistic people have to interact in all parts of society, if you want me to come and tell you about what it's like to be autistic, I will. Autism outreach shouldn't just be at autism events. In addition, I am the author of several books, fiction and nonfiction. Some I've wrote on my own, some I've written with other individuals. I'm also a professional recorder player who has recorded several CDs. And finally, I am a very active extracurricular volunteer at a public high school in Illinois known as Glenbrook North High School. So when I'm not traveling and I'm back in my hometown of Northbrook, Illinois, I'll be at Glenbrook North High School helping out with athletics and the choir and theater programs.
That's amazing. You do so many things. I mean, and I know for your career, your life story, as you mentioned, you wear different hats. What helps you, James, as an autistic human being? What helps you if somebody, a family, right, is watching our interview? What helps you to work with the daily challenges, not only in your work, but in your life? That helps you to keep moving forward. What is that factor that
Well, what I
helps you?
tell people is that It is very easy to think because I travel on my own and because I'm often seen independent without my family when I travel and when I attend events and do my work, that I am solely managing things on my own. But that is completely far from the truth. The truth is, I rely very heavily on my family and friends in the places I travel to give me the help and support I need. And the truth is, if it wasn't for those people, I wouldn't be able to do the work that I do. I rely on people that I am friends with to open their doors to me, let me stay with them in the cities I travel to, sometimes help me with transportation, sometimes help me with meals and other expenses. I also do rely on parental support to help fund some of the work that I do as well. And what I tell people is that just because I travel independently doesn't mean that I'm independent. And in fact, I admire family members who are out there helping support their autistic children and autistic individuals in their families. Because the truth is, one reason why I'm such a promoter of those individuals speaking up is because a lot of autistic people I know, even those who live amazing, meaningful lives, even those who are contributing to society, they aren't doing it on their own. They still depend on their families. They still depend on a support system. And I think that we in the autism community need to be more realistic about our expectations of independence for autistic adults. I have many friends in the Hispanic community who've helped me understand that there are many Hispanic cultures who do not expect the same independence that we do in our American culture. I'm not speaking for every Hispanic culture. There's a lot of diversity among that culture, among those cultures. And I'm also not trying to assume that every Hispanic person is Mexican. That's an often misconception people have. But I think there's a lot we can learn from the Hispanic community by realizing that our expectations of full independence are a uniquely American expectation. Not all cultures expect independence, and a lot of autistic people will never fully become independent of their families and their support systems, but that doesn't mean they can't live meaningful lives. Just because I still depend on my mom and my dad for some of my needs doesn't mean I'm not living a meaningful, happy life.
And well said. I mean, all of us have a support, some more than others, some other more than others. We have to look things in terms of context. All of us come from different backgrounds, culture, where we come from, where we raised, the circumstances that led us being part of my life, of our lives, that got to this point. I mean, that's, I believe that, based on, I always tell people, sure, there's different levels of autism, right? Level one, high functioning, right? Or level two, moderate. Or they tell me about the level three, the more profound. Right now, it's why they talk about, profound or more classic or severe autism. But that doesn't mean they're incapable of living a great life. Again, it's about giving them the tools and the supports to achieve the best quality of life that they can. And I believe that every human being has that potential to achieve a better life if they need the supports. And there's nothing to be ashamed about that. We need to write the supports. And I think that's important. We need to talk about all of that more than ever in our community. That's the reality. And I appreciate you, James, for sharing that experience. And that's amazing that you're sharing all of this with us in this interview. I mean, so very proud of you. Proud of you, Will, as well.
Yeah,
And
thank you.
again, right now we're about to be about about to close our interview. But any message? I'm going to give you the floor to for you, James. If you also want to participate at this, Will, you're more than welcome to do so. I wanted to give you the floor to say a message to the autism community, whether you have parents, families, autistic individuals, professionals, or maybe watching this interview right now. What message do you have for our community?
Well, although it is often said that autistic people often struggle with understanding idioms, there is one idiom that I am aware of that in many ways actually reflects how autistic people often see the world and what they need from others. And that is that idiom that a person is a person of their work. And truth be told, when you are autistic and you struggle with picking up unspoken social rules and you struggle with so many things that society doesn't want you to speak openly about, you often have to be a person of your word. And what I say to people is, we can't always pick up things that you don't talk to us about. We sometimes need to communicate about things that you might not always communicate about. Because autistic people, some of our biggest struggles are things that are kept silent. Some of us may be dealing with struggles related to puberty, growing up. Some of us may be struggling with sensitive issues, like some of us may have had issues with toilet training as children. Some of us might be struggling with menstruation. Some of us may be struggling with dating issues or sexuality. But what we need is people who will talk to us about our struggles, even if society says that certain things need to be kept silent. You might be asking, James, why are you bringing this up? Guess what? Some of the hardest struggles autistic people go through are the things society keeps silent. In my high school, we had a tradition sponsored by our Gay Straight Alliance called the Day of Silence, in which people chose to take an oath of silence during the school day, mostly students, to support LGBT people who were not able to come out. And when I took part in that, I did so because I said to myself, there's so many things that autistic people go through that are silenced too. And so a slogan for the Day of Silence is, what will you do to end the silence? And what I tell people is, the best way to be an ally to an autistic person is fight to challenge the silence of so many struggles we face, no matter what those struggles may be.
Well, that's amazing, and you're an inspiration. You both of you have a story of perseverance, persevering through all the challenges, and again, James, I think our community, I know, I think our community should be, grateful to your service, to your outstanding work. As I said, every time that I had the honor and privilege to meet you, seeing you in person, at least once or once per year in Florida, I always trying to learn more. And again, this for me was not an interview, but for me it was more like going to school and going to the class and learning from other advocates. So I want to say thank you for participating, James. Will, it's a pleasure. Thank you
Yeah,
for
you're
participating
welcome.
as well, James. How can people reach out to you? How can people support your work? Do you have a website? How they can buy your books, CDs? How can they do so?
Yeah, so I have a website, jamesmw.com. So jamesmw.com. On that website, there's links to an online store where people can buy my books and my CDs. I also have archives of historic presentations I've written on that website that anyone can read for free. I also have two YouTube channels, a music channel called James as James, and a professional channel called James Williams Presenter and Author with Autism, where people can view videos of presentations that I made mostly during the COVID pandemic. I also, that you can contact me by email at JMW820, that's the number 820, not water, H2O, it's JMW820@comcast.net, or James as James and the number 820@gmail.com. Those who want to support my work can always give me donations via PayPal through the name Pied Piper with a capital P 11030, or by way of Venmo under the alias Pied Piper 11030, 11030 with a capital P. So that's my information for contacting. And since you mentioned my music, I figured I'm going to close by playing a traditional public domain folk song from both Ireland and Scotland. It is a song that is known from both places. In Ireland, it is known as Red as the Rose, and in Scotland, it is known as Loch Lomond.
This is amazing. Again, we're going to close, and then we'll finish with your son, James. And then again, I wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you. Thank you for coming in. Always the best for you. Always the best for you, Will. And keep moving forward towards always making that difference for our autism community. And I appreciate everybody who tuned into this episode. Share it with everybody that you know, especially in our community. And this has been, and again, thank you so much, James. Thank you again so much, Will. And this has been another episode of My Time with Tony Hernandez Pumarejo. And now we're going to close it with James. Thank you so much.
And thank you for interviewing us.
Thank you.
This is the end of another episode of My Time with Tony Hernandez Pumarejo. Tony hopes you liked it. If you'd like to learn more about the work Tony does, subscribe to him on his social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, which is now X, and his LinkedIn page. You can also follow Tony on his website at TonyHernandezPumarejo.com. Also, if you are interested in getting a copy of his book, An Autism Unscripted Life, you can purchase it on Amazon or any book-selling platform. You can also obtain a copy through his website. So, until the next time you meet, thank you and have a wonderful day. Blessings.